mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
If we're seeing a weakening labor force, the bond market, the treasuries have been following the labor market pretty closely. So if there are indications that the labor market is weaker than we think it actually is, then that could be beneficial for mortgage rates going into 2026.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. It is December 15th, rolling up on the end of the year here. A really packed, really good episode for you today. We'll get right into a market update here in a few moments. A lot going on there, finally. We're going to get unemployment tomorrow. We had a Fed meeting last week, you know, starting to talk about what does the rate path look like for 2026. So we'll get into that. And then we're going to do our entire year in review after the market update. So we'll look at just everything that impacted, especially interest rates and the mortgage industry, but also just big events that affected the financial industry in 2025. And then next week, we'll cover 2026 and what to look forward to and what the rate path might look like and how we want to prepare for the new year. First, just a little bit of data. OBMMI, conventional 30-year, 6.25. 10-year, still just above 4.18. So about a 200 basis point spread there, which is nice. It's quite a bit narrower than it was this time last year, but still not quite able to break into the five handle, but still really good volume. We have easily 40% more volume now than we did this time last year. Typically going into the holidays, we're completely anemic, but looking pretty good. Overall, and we'll see, 20%+ increase overall for originations in 2025 than 2024. So the, folks like the MBA, their predictions are coming true this year. All right, let's go check in with Kevin, Alex, and James and start our market update. Okay, before we get into our year in review, we got a nice smattering of information to talk about just in this last week or so, and then a big number coming out tomorrow, right? Alex, you want to start with the FOMC results from last week?
Yeah, so as expected, the FOMC delivered a 25 basis point rate cut, so rounding out the year with 75 basis points in total cuts. And then Powell came out and it didn't seem to offend any market views. I think probably the largest surprise of this, wouldn't call it a shock, but maybe just a small surprise, was that the Fed said that they were going to begin with short-term bill purchases again.
Right. So looking to steepen the curve, didn't offend the markets, even by kind of saying what everybody was thinking, which is this is a hawkish cut, right? Like this is potentially the last one for a while. And a good chunk of the Fed voters are thinking maybe inflation is still a problem and we don't necessarily need to loosen the belt very far.
Yeah, it does seem to be swinging that way. The one vote change that occurred at this meeting was Goolsbee joined Schmidt in calling for no cut and a pause in any movement. So now it's Schmidt and Goolsbee there for the pause. Everyone else, sans Myron, calling for the quarter point, and Myron called for his usual aggressive 50 basis points.
Yes, indeed he did, and he will probably continue to do that, although it's been a little less. You're still not seeing the haters on like X and Truth Social like we were back when it's almost seemed like they were trying to beat the drum to the point where they thought maybe Powell would just leave, right? or somehow get fired for cause. But that seems to have slowed down. And now you've got half the Fed not necessarily fully on board with slashing interest rates.
Yeah. I think the labor pressures are far more at the forefront. It doesn't seem like we've had a serious conversation about inflation really this year. You know, the CPI, PPI numbers come and go, but it really hasn't like reared its head so much this year. It's floated between 2.5% and 3%, and 3% is the new 2%. So, and again, every meeting they say we're okay with this. You know, we're keeping our eye on it, but we're okay with this.
Right. I mean, speaking of jobs, we're getting a number tomorrow, finally, an almost on-time number, right? We'll get November non-farm. And then at the same time, there was a little bit of noise from Jerome Powell himself just about surrounding how we count jobless claims, right? That was kind of an interesting coincidence with the numbers coming out tomorrow. So I guess, what are we expecting tomorrow? And then how might some of the comments from Jerome Powell about labor kind of feed into what we see going into the end of the year, going into next year?
Yeah. It's expected to be a relatively weak jobs report. It's expected to show 50,000 new jobs in the economy. This kind of comes up against a Wall Street Journal article that I think you're referring to that came out last week, that their investigation showed, and maybe some slight whistleblower activity there, but inside the BLS, it appears that there are some admissions that they don't think the jobs numbers have been as accurate as they could be. They cited some issues with the birth-death model, so just roughly how many people are in the picture for the model, in addition to just like chronic shortages on labor, you know, due to DOGE cuts and the government shutdown. They're definitely overworked over there. We talked about in the middle of the summer about that they've been using interpolation far more often than they would like, where, they don't particularly have, like an inflation metric for a particular city. They might just lean on that region of the country's inflation metric for the city far more than they otherwise would. And that seems to be affecting all the metrics that are coming out. This Wall Street Journal article, the kind of the headline for it was that if the kind of birth-death model and everything that they said is as inaccurate as they say, there's probably more of a contraction in the labor force than was otherwise put out by the BLS, to the tune of maybe 20, 30,000 jobs.
Right. We've seen that cited before. I feel like another aspect was, especially in this economy, like newer and or smaller businesses aren't being surveyed at all. So you could have small businesses of 20 to 50 people that are going out of business or slashing jobs because of whatever reason, economic slowdown, tariffs, just bad business cycle. And those are not being counted at all, right? So there could be a lot of that effect. If we're only looking at large 1,000-plus employee businesses, we could be missing a big part of that picture that is going to be quicker to hire and fire people in the labor force.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about those numbers last week about how it appeared that it seemed to be a definite contraction in the small business environment. And I'm with you. I think if a business goes out of business, the last thing you're going to do is respond to someone polling on your current employment trends. So there definitely could be some more hidden pain there.
And especially over the course of this year, we've seen a number of larger job revisions. A lot of that's going to be chalked up to the tariffs and just market volatility that we've seen. But this has been kind of a complaint of people for a while right now, right? Like 22, 23, 24, people felt, hey, maybe these job numbers are kind of a little overstated here. Now in 2025, we've seen layoffs from all over the market, but they don't seem to translate as well. It's kind of a, how does this square the circle? And just this admission that, hey, we need to look at this model again and tighten it up a bit. And I think in the Wall Street Journal article, they even said like the plan is for 26 to tighten this up. It's kind of a known discrepancy that they have. So that it lines up very well with what we've seen and have been expecting. So,
yeah, and all of this, just to tie it back to the mortgage market, obviously, if we're seeing a weakening labor force, the bond market, treasuries have been following the labor market pretty closely. So if there are indications that the labor market is weaker than we think it actually is, then that could be beneficial for mortgage rates going into 2026. So definitely have to keep an eye on it. It certainly seems like the main headline that I'm taking away is there is just much more uncertainty around the labor market as we go into the end of the year than maybe we were expecting to see.
Right. Yeah, we're in that uncomfortable position always where we're kind of you know, if there is some issues with the labor market, we are going to benefit from that. As you said, Kevin, we're going to should get lower interest rates, but obviously don't want anybody to suffer and don't want the economy to slow down or even contract or have that recession that folks have been predicting for, I don't know, the last decade. All right. Anything else on just the data front this week? It looks like some Fed speak, which will be timely with the unemployment number coming out. We'll have CPI also this week, along with jobless claims. That's a big one. Jobless claims have ticked up pretty heavily, right? I've seen that that number doesn't get enough airplay. It probably should have got even more during the government shutdown when we weren't getting BLS reports. But that number, I believe, spiked higher than it's been since 2021, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know if it spiked beyond 2021, but it did return to levels we were seeing in the late summer, early fall. We were saying like a 250,000 initial jobless claims for a week is kind of that tipping point that we would call out as, okay, like there's a major issue in the labor market. As of last week, it was back to 223, 4-week trailing average, which is probably the better one to use all year round, but especially this time of year, just because there's so much seasonal hiring, hiring and letting go, especially, you know, January once the holiday rush is over. But we saw 216,000 on the 4-week trailing average, which isn't really in line with those headline layoffs that we've seen, you know, so some larger technology firms. So yeah, that one's coming out on Thursday. We're really getting both sides of the coin this week. We're getting unemployment on Tuesday, followed by CPI and initial jobless claims on Thursday. So I think this will really set the tone for into the first part of 2026.
Right. Yeah. The initial jobless claims in some ways is a better number because it doesn't rely on a survey. It's actually people who have applied for unemployment benefits, right? But we could be missing some people in that, right? Especially with, you know, again, back to some of the immigration issues and the, you know, folks staying home and choosing not to go to work because of some of the situations with ICE and all of that. Like, it's possible you're not looking to collect benefits if you're in that situation. So it's only part of the picture, I guess, because these are just folks who have chosen to apply for unemployment benefits initially.
Right. And if you were separated with some sort of severance package, there could be a delay there as well, you know, before you make that initial claim. So it could be a lagging metric in that regard as well.
Sure. Good point. All right. Anything else we need to cover here, gentlemen?
I want to touch one more on the unemployment is that there's a lot of youth unemployment, people right out of college. And in order to apply for unemployment, you have to have worked. So if you've never had a job, you've never paid Social Security, paid into the system, you can't apply. So any number of students who have graduated in the past year that, you know, never had an internship or, you know, worked at Chipotle over the summer, they don't count. So that's probably a part of the number that we don't see that exists.
Excellent point. Excellent. Yeah, that we'd rely on a survey to find those folks who just got out of school and are looking to have their first job but are unable to find it. And that we certainly see that in the headlines that new high school or college grads are having a pretty difficult time finding work compared to the last few years.
Yep. Yeah, we talked about that on the webinar just last week. And just to bring it to the podcast audience here, the numbers that the Federal Reserve is seeing for those with a bachelor's in the 22 to 28-year-old category, it's spiked to a level not seen since the kind of the recovery years of the global financial crisis, levels we haven't seen since 2012, 2013. So that kind of gives you a picture of where we might be at. Obviously, there's seasonality to it as well as folks graduate in May and find jobs throughout the summer. The latest numbers that we had in September were right around, like I said, 2013, 2014 or so.
Yeah, those are rough years for those of you who were around back then. I certainly remember it, not just in the mortgage industry after the meltdown, but just across the economy, across the world, really. It was just a difficult time to change jobs, to find your first job, to obtain gainful employment. So hopefully we're just scraping the bottom there and we start to pick up a little bit here as seasonality kicks in. Going into the, you know, graduation season again, which is coming up here just in a few months.
That was also how I got started in the mortgage market as well. That was one of the few bright spots in the early 2010s, you know, for folks graduating school. So who knows, you know, this time around, maybe not so much, right? With rates a bit higher than they were in the, you know, 2010s. But yeah, I've also been seeing headlines of folks, you know, going, people with computer science degrees who are choosing to go into construction or, you know, other types of industries, you know, maybe different from what they were expecting, just given the state of the overall market. So
more to come on this. All right. Let's move over to the year in review. All right. Here we are. We're back talking through just what had an impact on 2025, right? We'll talk a little bit about what had pressure on rates, what just caused just narratives in our industry. We'll talk about just what affected our economy. There's just so much we could say. So we'll try to stick to things that really influence the industry, influence rates. I mean, if anything, I'd say in our industry, we've made incremental progress. We've seen a very interesting political climate develop this year. Rates have been sticky, so not a ton to talk about there in terms of impact, but lots of debt, you know, coming online and probably threatening to come online in the future. Let's get right into it. You know, as far as upward pressure on rates, as I just mentioned, you know, massive debt supply. We've got our own national debt, which is rising higher than it's ever been every single minute of every day. You've got defense spending rising. Some of that is due to some of our pressure on NATO and just generally speaking, and you know, a challenging global climate right now in terms of conflict, and probably that gets worse before it gets better. And then meanwhile, not just stateside but across the world, just tech investment, right now you could think of that as AI, you could think of that as semiconductors, but there's also energy that comes behind that, where we need to, you know, need to build out energy for these data centers, factories that build the chips, and so on. And that's largely funded by debt. You don't read about that as much. You know, you hear about Apple investing in whatever. In a lot of cases, they have to issue bonds to get that done. What else had upward pressure on rates this year, do you guys think?
Just taking the tech angle, I feel like a lot of that CapEx spending by the Magnificent Seven, definitely major upward pressure on rates. Upward pressure on real rates, which I posted about, I think last week, were the main driver of sort of our regime in the 2020 interest rate regime versus the 2010s is what those real interest rates are, which are, you know, 1 to 2 points higher in a lot of cases. And that's really just a function of the economy competing for capital. There's a lot of investment that's happening, whether that's public investment and government spending, or private investments in, you know, the promise of technology, which is driving all of the major returns in the stock market, you know, for equities. And you know, that's ultimately causing the time value of money to go up even more so than inflation, at least this year, relatively speaking. The tech story is definitely a major one in terms of interest rates.
Sure. Probably inflation. Like, inflation hasn't been out of control, but it's one of the few things that's keeping the Fed from cutting rates, right? Keeping policy restrictive. Mm-hmm. And just generally, if folks think that dollars are going to be worth less in the future, you're going to be able to buy less stuff. That just kind of keeps rates higher. There's competing priorities there and competing dollars to invest.
Mm-hmm. I'll throw out another one too, which is just overall volatility. We definitely saw in the first half of the year, probably a bit more so than the second half, driving up the term premium on bonds, and also just, you know, the fluctuations with the US dollar, you know, big sell-off in the first half of the year, come back a little bit in the second half, but still very much down for the year. Also having an impact on rates, you know, longer term securities in general. I just think that the more uncertainty or volatility that you get, longer duration assets, say MBS, mortgage-backed securities, the 10-year treasury, are going to feel it more. You're going to get more upward pressure on rates than you are in the shorter end of the curve, you know, when you're in a volatile environment like that. Thankfully, we've seen some of that volatility decrease and help the MBS spread throughout 2025. Definitely saw a downward trend, you know, much more so in the second half of the year, which is nice. So that's that second biggest component of mortgage rates, in addition to, you know, what's happening with the 10-year. So, you know, that's definitely a positive story, but there's some indications that, you know, there is still some risk in that going forward. I know we'll talk about that when we do our look forward into 2026. But yeah, those are some of the big things, certainly from my perspective.
I think the underlying item that both of you are kind of touching around here was Liberation Day, right? That was one of the biggest events of, shockingly, this year. It flies so fast, doesn't it? But the market really crushed itself the day after, and then very quickly they rolled some of them back, and it all caused a ton of volatility. Conversation over in Europe and Asia about the nuclear option of selling U.S. Treasury bonds as a punishment, that causes a lot of fear, a lot of uncertainty, and just what was going to happen. You know, the entire traditional economic theory would be that inflation should have really crushed us over the course of this year. But with enough pressure in the job market, maybe helping to slow that down, we've really just seen a turbulent ocean that we've been sailing on. So that really feels like one of the most significant events. You know, it kind of hits on everything. It was an administrative move. It impacted the world. It ends up pushing inflation up, makes it harder for the Fed to cut rates, causes a lot of volatility. It's the full sweep. And we have a couple items like that this year that you could point to. The government shutdown, DOGE cuts causing uncertainty just with the job market and the government. There's a lot of items that we could point to as kind of the biggest event of the year.
Yeah, big, beautiful bill is in there somewhere, right? Like this new administration, so much different, like unique stuff that was piled onto the market. And you could say that it caused volatility, meaning it pushed rates up and down at different times of the year, depending on what the mood was or what the general consensus was on where we were going. As you said, like when the tariffs first came out in April, it was a bloodbath there for a minute. But then we came back stronger in equities. Rates are lower now than they've been all year. It's just kind of interesting how all these things have interplayed with each other, and we've yet to see the full effect of it. I mean, we're still right in the middle of the tariff discussion, right? There's nothing set in stone there.
All massive impacts on the market this year. A tertiary one that I think is perhaps underappreciated on the labor front is the immigration policies of the Trump administration, and how I think it's very much so, whether forced or voluntary, you know, muddied the picture on where exactly the labor market is right now, just because we're working with far fewer people than we began the year with, which is keeping, I think, the unemployment rate a bit suppressed than it otherwise would be had all things remained the same on regards to immigration policy.
For sure. Again, a very unique situation there, right? Like we've not ever seen this kind of negative immigration in our country. Meanwhile, you have all these other extraneous factors going on that are going to ultimately affect the labor market. And then I guess to tie a bow on the administration's effect on interest rates this year was just the up and downs with the Fed, right? Like for a while there, it was getting tense. Like there was like an immediate threat to the independence of the Fed, it felt like, for a while. And it felt like by now we would have been 100% owned, the Fed would be owned by the White House. But that seems, it died off a little bit yet. You know, we'll get into this next week when we talk 2026, but it's coming still. It's just a little bit delayed. So what effect did that have on rates throughout the year when there was that threat of kind of that separation was going to be narrowed at the same time that we had foreign countries looking at us and saying, should we dump American treasuries because of what's going on over there? And you know, that was putting that upward pressure on rates. Meanwhile, the White House is calling for 2 points in cuts. Just a wild ride.
Yeah. I remember like some nights in April, you know, post Liberation Day, you know, but still in that area where we didn't really know exactly how things were going to shake out once the 10-year started trading in Asia, or the 30-year, just watching that just like, you know, go up, and a lot of chatter online about what was going to happen there, liquidity, you know, issues. And yeah, that was a wild ride for sure that time of the year. If you were an astute listener of the Optimal Insights podcast, you might remember us hearing and talking through that really the only thing that made sense at the time, the only framework to make sense of it was, you know, as a negotiating tactic, because given the level of the high level of tariffs that were implemented, very likely would have caused a recession, which would not bring back manufacturing jobs. It would not, you know, collect enough income to offset the trigger recessionary spending that happens. Those other two options that were narratives that were out there really didn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, ultimately we saw the only one that sort of made sense become, you know, really the dominating narrative throughout the rest of the year. But that was certainly a crazy time, you know, watching equities go down, you know, 10%+, I think 15%+ at, you know, at some point. And, you know, I've sort of got this theory or, you know, opinion that I have, which is the president really doesn't influence the economy that much for the most part. You know, the president always, if the economy is doing well, the president will take the credit. If the economy is doing bad, the president will get the blame. You know, that's all just sort of, you know, politics out there. But in my opinion, I just feel like the U.S. economy is just this much bigger thing with, you know, so dynamic, and it's really hard for one person or even, you know, one political party to influence it too much. I think that, you know, the trends just are end up being bigger. But this is one of those years where it really was the federal government that had a massive impact just all throughout the U.S. economy and in so many different ways. From everything that we talked about, from tariffs to, you know, the labor force, immigration policy, the relationship with the Federal Reserve, I feel like that's really one of the defining characteristics of this year was the actual involvement of the federal government in the U.S. economy, and the way that it sort of tipped the scales in different directions, you know, ultimately led us to where we are here at the end of December.
Yeah, it's a really good point, Kevin, and it's not lost on the administration, I'm sure. I mean, you know, it started immediately with a very, very business focused president, obviously. I mean, that Donald Trump is first and foremost a businessman, right? So yeah, I think it was, they went to work immediately, and most of what they've been working on has been economic related, right? Whether it has to do with immigration, which indirectly affects the economy, the tariffs, taxes, big, beautiful bill, just, yeah, run down the list. And then this is where I struggled with this one. And we've struggled with it all year in our industry. What could and did put downward pressure on rates? And I had difficulty stringing together a list because there was not many items, right? Global tensions, for sure. I mean, there's multiple wars going on. We had our scuffle with Iran, which was, we got really close to getting into our own war there. We've had, obviously, the war in Ukraine, the war in Gaza. Those are typically going to mean lower rates over time. But we haven't had, it hasn't been enough to push rates, you know, mortgage rates below 6% this year. So what, was there anything else this year that stuck out as a catalyst to push rates lower?
The job revisions, right? October, we saw that nasty job revision looking back 3 months and saying, okay, this has had an impact where we're really slowing. It's not as stable as we thought it was. That definitely, you know, talk about convincing the Fed whether or not to do rate cuts. If that report had not come out, do you think we would have 3 this year? I'm not sure we would have 2, right? We probably would have sat where we are. I think that's the most influential item as to cutting rates this year. Now, what else is pushing it down? It is a hard question to find.
Yeah, I would agree with you, James. I think, you know, the softening of the labor market, definitely probably the big story there. And a lot of that came through with the revisions. And I think, like, really the other thing is just the easing of the upward pressure, you know, forces as those sort of started to become not, you know, first order narratives, but, you know, back burner narratives, however you want to describe them, that allowed some more space for the labor market to dominate the conversation and ultimately, you know, have that negative impact on rates, downward pressure on rates.
So a more passive effect to allow, like you said, allow the space for rates to drift lower, like inflation. Inflation much lower of a concern in 25 than it was in 24. So taking the focus off of that, you can allow the job stuff to be a bigger deal. You can allow some of the global conflicts to be a bigger deal. That's a good point as well.
Overriding all this, though, I think something to keep in mind is just how sticky those higher rates have been. The jobs revision that James talked about, you know, was a temporary reprieve. You know, we saw a locking bonanza there for a few weeks, but if you go back and look at September 17th, the 10-year, and you look at it today, you know, we're higher after 75 basis points of cutting. The OBMI is higher as well, not as much as the 10-year is, but from a pure basis point value, thanks to, as Kevin mentioned, those narrowing mortgage spreads. But yeah, just the temporary nature of these, what we're highlighting is you know, downward pressures. So it leaves much to be desired.
Yeah, the upward pressure just is still there, and it's consistent, and you get a reprieve here and there, and you know, it's been better for mortgage rates. I think, like you said earlier, the spread has shrunk, where you know, treasuries are certainly flat or higher. Mortgage rates have been allowed to drift a little bit lower, which I think is good for us. You get about 200 basis points, right, between 10-year, the OBMMI, which is back to a healthier range compared to 2.5 to 3 that we've seen since the pandemic, which just keeps, you know, mortgage rates artificially higher when all else being equal. What else just had an effect, or kind of tangentially even related to our industry? I mean, there was some other stuff that involved the administration that really hasn't, there hasn't been a ton of news out about it. I feel like the CFPB, whatever happened with that, right? They were essentially neutralized at some point, but I haven't heard much about the CFPB, maybe TBD in 26.
Yeah, I think that'd be something that's slow, little things you'll notice here and there. It's not going to be the every day you wake up, your day is materially worse, but it'll be a slow grind, you know, on the little things as they slip through.
The thing I was going to mention was that there's, I know a number of states have gotten together to kind of fill the void of the CFPB, and I think just brought over one of the former head of the CFPB to help with their, you know, regulatory confederacy, you know, however you want to characterize that. The state level financial regulatory enforcement, definitely something to that we'll talk about next week about what the impact might be in 2026.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a theme with, if you remember, even to the first Trump administration, right? It's certainly a Republican thing to be less federal government, put more in the hands of the states. But President Trump, especially from my recollection, first term, a big theme was putting more power in the hands of the states, and the CFPB, potentially abolishing the CFPB and moving it towards the states makes a lot of sense in that narrative.
And the CFPB's role as a regulator, right, is to make sure people are following the rules or just what we've put in place to protect consumers. And so as the CFPB gets shut down, branches of it are closing, layoffs were happening within it, DOGE was stripping people out, you would hope the first thing that, you know, a CEO of some company doesn't do is, oh, I'm allowed to do this again? Right. You would think, hey, we've learned some lessons in the past. The reason that these regulations were created were because of serious bruises that the market took. Even if that regulation goes away, you might be able to get away with it. You might not want to dip your toe into that water, knowing what could happen further down the line.
Right. Perhaps we're self-regulating is the thought or the hope.
Or it takes you a while to make the same mistakes.
Sure. give it time.
Yeah, the fact that the CFPB, they're still there, like the framework's still there. All you need is another administration who's going to, you know, change the approach. And, you know, there's still a look back period there in terms of, you know, what the next head of the CFPB might be looking at. So it's definitely not just a, you know, a free for all now that the CFPB is taking its foot off the gas with our industry, for sure.
Granted. All right, a couple more things I want to be sure we cover. Just housing market, right? Starting to see a slowdown there finally in price appreciation. Actually, I'd argue we're seeing depreciation if you look at the averages or even look at certain pretty important MSAs that skyrocketed during the COVID years, seeing decreases. Listings are increasing, just seeing probably what amounts to a more healthy housing market, right? Depending on who you ask, I think supply is better than it's been since COVID. In fact, a spoiler alert for next week, I'm going to call that we're going to have a housing correction in 2026. I know most of us homeowners don't want to hear that, but then again, we all want to see affordability get better. Wages are not going to double next year. Interest rates are not going to drop to 3% most likely. So I could see a decent housing correction next year. Nothing like we saw in 07, 08, but just something that resembles a more healthy just pullback to the point where hopefully it unlocks some existing home supply in the process.
Yeah, I think that's I've definitely seen some forecasts that are, you know, that are have a negative in front of the number nationally. So I certainly don't think that's out of the question. And I think the regional factors have been probably the biggest surprise for me since 2022. But talking about the story of this year, 2025 as well, the Northeast is still the really one of the only markets where you're still continuing to see that appreciation. Now it's a little bit outside of the bigger metros. You got to get to the second order or third order metros where you're still seeing those, fairly sizable appreciations. Upstate New York, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, the upper Midwest and, Midwest in general, has been a bit more flat. And then basically everywhere south and west has been, I think, mostly negative on the year, not significantly so, but, in the Southeast, in Texas, Colorado.
Yeah, Austin got hammered pretty good. It's a lot of those strong positives that you saw during COVID have switched to negative, right? It's just a little more volatile, it feels like.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. And just areas where there's more housing supply as well, where you can start to see the effects of that demand decrease much more so, the Northeast, which is all built up. There's no land here. There's no development. It is what it is at this point. but yeah, definitely will be interesting to watch there. So now we got you on record, Jim. So we'll have to recap at the end of 2026 and see how this plays out.
I think it has to happen. All right. Last but not least, we got to touch on some of the creativity or attempted creativity to come out of FHFA. It's not too far in the rearview mirror at this point. Barry Habib was brought in to meet with the FHFA to talk ideas. We thought maybe we were going to get a reprieve from LLPAs, maybe even a G fee move. That hasn't happened yet. The 50-year mortgage just came out to just some disappointment, I think, or just almost anger, it felt like. But again, I appreciate the creativity. I think we have to get creative. There's this wishing for 3% rates or wishing for affordability to magically improve just is not productive. I do think I applaud Pulte and the White House and the FHFA for trying to figure something out. But again, I struggle with how that could work without the GSEs making less money. And they've been a cash cow since conservatorship. So you can't have both. So I don't know what that looks like next year. And we'll talk about some possible ideas. But anyway, that struck me too as something material that happened this year that almost made it.
I definitely appreciate the same. Anyone who's got ideas, to throw out there to try and help things, great. That's wonderful. What's been thrown out this year so far, I think really underscores that this is not a problem with a silver bullet to solve. I think that's the biggest takeaway. There's no 50-year solution. There's no assumable solution. This is a big structural issue. As you said, Jim, GSEs play a huge role in that. And it's not, it isn't something that's going to be solved with a headline for sure. I think that's the biggest takeaway of kind of watching some of that come out of FHFA and other places this year for me.
Yeah, probably need to spend money. And that's not ever a popular idea, especially when we're in record deficits.
And Jim, the GSEs, they could take the hit and earn less, lower the G fee, try and help make a 50-year rate more sensible. But to do that, they'd have to be some sort of, quasi-government institute. And if they were to go released from conservatorship and be competing in the market, then they really would not be able to do that. So it's just one of those, giving them up is always a hard pitch.
Saying goodbye is hard to do. Yes. Yeah, you can't have both. To your point, they're conflicting concepts, privatization versus actually lowering rates. It's just there's not that silver bullet. All right, let's end it here by going around the room. Just rattle off what you think is the most impactful event this year. Maybe it affected interest rates. Maybe it just affected the economy in our country. What was the biggest for you, Alex?
I'm going to go on long-term rates. I think the underscored inflation, long-term inflation dynamics at play on the rates market. I think when you're looking at the 10 plus year lending market, I think a lot of inflation is being priced in there right now. And to meaningfully bring those down, I think we need to tamp down on the fears of inflation. You know, we've allowed it to drift to 3% or so a year. And, you know, when you compound that over 10 years, it is a meaningful difference from 2%. So that's something I'm keeping an eye on.
Good one. James?
I think I would say the Doge cuts were probably the biggest item of the year in my eyes. Just because, you know, the government does a ton of things. And just because you don't know what this department was doing or what that money was going towards, you don't notice now that it's stopped today, doesn't mean 20 years from now you won't know exactly what they were doing. So it's kind of a long-term item for me, but tens of thousands of layoffs, you know, billions cut out of the government. It's good for savings, but what is it going to mean in the long term is a really lingering thing.
Right. And James had a front row seat to a lot of that too. If y'all aren't aware, James lives in the DC area, so he's seen it with his own eyes, right? How it affects people. And
I joke to this, but you know, at the beginning of 25, the James Cahill friends and family unemployment rate was pretty close to zero. It's pretty close to like 20%. I know a significant amount of people without jobs now.
Yeah. Doge was real.
Hate to hear that.
How about you, Kevin? Biggest impact on 2025?
So I'm gonna go a little bit deeper, and I'm gonna say the rollout of GPT-5 was a major moment, and the reason was because there was a lot of hype leading up to it. What can it do? How's it gonna be? Is it gonna be, you know, super intelligence? And it wasn't. And it, for a lot of people, for, you know, majority of people, I think it was kind of a disappointment, and I think shows how we're really just pushing the limits. Number one, pushing the limits of what AI can do. So to me, having that whatever AGI, you know, ASI being out there, it's farther down the road, I think, than what people might have thought in 2025. And the second thing around that is I think it showed that the models and the companies that own these models don't have a moat, meaning you know, other players like Google, you know, big came out with Gemini 3 in the second half of the year. They're now getting into the game, and the monetization strategies for these companies, I think, are becoming increasingly important. And a lot of them have substantial monetization struggles right now with AI. And that, I think, you know, translate that back to all the CapEx spending that's happening right now in the area of AI, and then looking forward to what that means in 2026. I think we will find that when GPT-5 came out, that will be a bigger part of the story than maybe a lot of people might think right now.
Yeah, I feel like you said bubble without saying bubble. But yeah, I think AI was an enormous story this year. We touched on it a little bit with some of the spending discussion, but didn't really get into it. We could talk forever, right, about how AI has affected our lives. It affects potentially the unemployment rate, at least as far as excuses for why people are getting laid off or not getting hired out of college. But time's going to tell, like you said. Like, AI still is in that infancy where it's literally as smart as a child, right? And the promise is that it exponentially grows in intelligence from here, but we haven't seen that yet. So how has the money come back versus, you know, what are we going to see in terms of winners and losers? Because that's all of these AI companies that are investing billions are not all going to win. Some of them are going to get, they don't have a moat. They're going to get, someone's going to eat their lunch for them. And it's going to be a few that are left standing, like we had with telecom, like we had with .com, like that's happened throughout history back to the Industrial Revolution. So yeah, that's going to play out over many, many years. I think that's a really good one. Man, I feel like the good ones have been taken. I'll take tariffs just because it's new, it's interesting. It didn't pan out the way anybody said it would. So to me, you know, kind of a confounding topic like that is interesting because it just rewrites logic, rewrites kind of economic teaching, which I always find amusing when everybody was wrong pretty much so far. Again, time's going to tell. We're not done. But we've not seen 20% inflation. We've not seen our adversaries dump our treasuries on the market. We've not seen some of the horrible effects that we might have. But then again, we haven't seen huge revenues, and the Supreme Court is still out on whether or not tariffs are even legal, which is special.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I kind of, I think we didn't come close to covering everything that happened this year, but I feel like we hit the big ones and how they affect each other, how they affect rates, how they affect our industry. So next week we will come back and talk about clean slate 2026 coming up. What should we be focused on? What's the Fed expected to do? Where's employment going to go? Like, next year is one of those years that people expect just to be flat for interest rates, right? Because they've kind of given up on any sort of conviction in one direction or the other. But that makes me think that next year might be the year we get surprised and something happens, whether it's globally or in the financial markets, that tends to then cause those unexpected moves in interest rates, which could be good or bad for our industry. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Wonderful conversation. Talk again soon.
Thanks, Jim.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
All right. Before we wrap up this episode and wrap up another amazing year, we're excited to announce a new way you can join our conversation. We've launched the Optimal Insights listener inbox, where you can suggest topics you'd like to hear on the show. So feel free to tell us what you enjoy about the show, what you'd like to hear more of, or even new concepts you'd like to suggest. We obviously can't get to all of them, but we will read all of the ideas and bring some of the best ones to our future episodes. So send us an email at podcast@optimalblue.com. Pretty simple email address. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you, James, Kevin, Alex. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.
Speed matters in lending, and borrowers expect instant answers. But traditional loan locking ties you to a desk, slowing decisions and creating friction. That's why Optimal Blue introduced mobile locking in our mobile app. Now, loan officers can lock loans anytime, anywhere, fast, secure, and accurate. Access your live pipeline, update loan details, run pricing, and complete locks right from your phone. No delays, no desk dependency, just instant action that enhances the borrower experience. Unlike browser-based tools, mobile locking is built into our native iOS and Android app for faster load times, stronger security, and a seamless experience. And the best part? It's included at no extra cost for all Optimal Blue PPE users. Download the Optimal Blue mobile app today and start locking loans on the go. Access, price, lock, it's that simple.